And good afternoon and evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Fulfilled Radio here on Two Guys in a Bible. My name is Don K. Preston. With me again is Daniel Rogers from Alabama. And we do appreciate so very, very much you being with us. And by the way, I just want to say a great big thank you for all of you who have been listening in to Two Guys in a Bible since it's being now posted on my YouTube channel. I'm continuing to get an increasing number of comments there, very, very positive feedback. So I want to express my appreciation to Daniel Rogers and Alan Morton, my webmaster, for taking the time to do whatever it is they have to do in order to get those things posted there on YouTube and to make them available on my YouTube channel. It just adds to the content there, obviously. And again, I'm just getting an increasing number of great comments from those audios. So I want to thank all of you who are listening. And we're going to continue to do that, pardon me, and make them available to you. So we are continuing our study of the Messianic Temple. And, you know, before we get there, I want to make an announcement here. We are putting the final touches on an agreement for a formal written debate between myself and a former professor, a PhD guy. He has in the past lived in Greece. That's his home country. I take it that he's currently living in America, but his name is Sergius Bale. And on Facebook, over the last several months, he has accosted me and all preterists for our insistence that the book of Revelation was written prior to the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And lately, he took it upon himself to say it was a ridiculous view, although he could not definitively prove that assertion, which I thought was a rather strange position to take. On the one hand, it's supposedly ridiculous. On the other hand, you can't prove that it is. So anyway, he just went on and on about how it's, you know, the late date is the well-attested date. I kept responding to him, asking for proof. And finally, I've forgotten now exactly what post that he made that precipitated it, but I just challenged him to debate the issue on Facebook. Now, on that particular Facebook page, the rule of that forum is that nothing posted there can be shared outside of that forum. Well, that forum only has, well, it's less than 200 members. And I can tell you this, a bunch of them are full preterists who are already convinced of the early date. So, first of all, he initially said he wasn't interested in debating the issue. Secondly, he reiterated his admission that although he takes the late date, that he cannot prove it definitively. However, the early date is false. And then finally, he sent me a private message. And he said, what would be your stipulations, your rules and regulations for such a debate? And I thought, well, that's interesting. He goes from... he goes from asserting that he can't prove the late date, but the early date is foolishness, to know he's not going to debate the issue, to now he's wanting to know what the rules are. So I drafted pretty much the standard rules that I have followed and proposed to other men when I was going to debate them down through the years, and I sent them to him. And as of this morning, he seems to have agreed. This morning, I posted a private message to him and asked him to go ahead, if he had no further objections of any kind, to go ahead and sign the propositions and the rules and get them back to me, and then we would proceed with the rest of the issues. I haven't heard from him today, so I don't. I've normally heard from him the same day that I posted to him. So I suspect that he is consulting with some other non-full preterists there on that page and basically asking them, should he proceed or not? And number two, if he should, then what about these rules and propositions? Should he do any changes? You know, what should he say? And I'm fully convinced that should he follow through? And as I said, as of this morning early before I posted to him, everything seemed to be a go. But I am absolutely fully persuaded that if he continues and follows through with the written debate, that I won't be debating just him. I will be debating every full preterist on that page who feel like they can help him out to answer the arguments that I'm going to make. And by the way, I also told him that in our negotiations, I said, I'm not going to agree to a debate unless the webmaster, unless the owner of that Facebook page agrees that I can post that debate in its entirety on not only on my Facebook pages, but on my websites as well. So I contacted the Facebook owner of that page, and he agreed to that. So all I'm waiting for now, literally, is for him to return the rules and regulations with his signature at the bottom. When he does that, I'm going to be posting everything on that Facebook page with the announcement that we have a signed agreement, and I'll also be posting it on my Facebook pages as well as on my web pages. So those of you who are interested in a debate on the dating of Revelation, that will be of some interest to you, I am sure. And so I'll keep you posted. Hopefully, he will follow through with what we seem to have as an agreement yesterday instead of hedging and trying to change everything in midstream. But again, I'll keep everyone posted. It is an important subject. And I'll throw this in there as a little bit of an extra bit of information. When I told him that I wanted to debate the subject of the debate of the dating of Revelation, he initially said it was irrelevant. It didn't matter. And I posted back and I said, I failed to see how anyone could say that the dating in the book of Revelation is irrelevant, because the book of Revelation is about the destruction of Babylon. If therefore Babylon was Old Covenant Jerusalem, then the entire eschatological narrative has to fall within that framework of a pre-AD 70 dating and an AD 70 fulfillment. And he never really posted in response to that. So it's amazing to me that anyone would even conceivably argue that the dating of the book of Revelation is really an irrelevant issue. I mean, Daniel, have you ever heard anyone argue like that before?
No, I have not heard that before. Usually, the very first thing you do when you're talking to somebody about the book of Revelation is get on the same page about the date, because, you know, obviously it can't be predictions of something that has already happened. That doesn't make much sense. That's not that impressive. Anybody can do that. That'd be like me telling the weather, you know, what the weather was like yesterday. That doesn't make me a meteorologist, you know.
Exactly right.
I was going to say, though, Don, being familiar with just the subject in general, there's a resource online. It's really a debate online that I thought that maybe some of the listeners would like to go and read. And it's on a website, aogden.com. You click on files to download, and the very top one is called Did Domitian Persecute Christians? It was a debate between Art Ogden, who wrote an excellent commentary on the book of Revelation, the avengings of the apostles and the prophets, and another brother named Farrell Jenkins. And so, yeah, they had a really good discussion in there about did Domitian persecute the Christians. And you should, before you read Don's debate, you might go look at that just so you can have a good grasp of the history that they might be getting into in the course of the debate. So,
yeah. Now, what was that website again?
That's A. Ogden. AOGDEN. Let me look back at it here. .com. That's right.
That's what I thought. Yeah, you know, I'll tell a very quick anecdote here before we get into our program today. Years and years ago, Arthur Ogden, he's passed away since then, but Arthur Ogden, he wrote that book, excellent, excellent book, on the avenging of the apostles and prophets. And Jack Scott, Terry Seivert, and I think one more individual attended a lectureship at which Arthur Ogden was preaching. And they had a Q&A session. And Jack was telling me about this, and Terry Seivert chimed in and agreed with it. He said, during the Q&A session, Jack said he stood up and introduced himself. Arthur Ogden didn't know him or Terry or anyone else. But anyway, he said, Brother Ogden, have I understood you to say, because in the sermon, Ogden had said, all Old Testament prophecy, every bit of it, has been fulfilled by AD 70. And so Jack didn't want to misrepresent. He said, did I understand you clearly? Did you say all Old Testament prophecy, every single prophecy made to Old Covenant Israel has been fulfilled and was fulfilled by AD 70? And Brother Ogden said, that is absolutely true. That is my position. And Jack says, well, Brother Ogden, I'm not trying to be confrontative. I'm not trying to be argumentative. I would just simply like to point out that the Old Testament predicts the second coming of the Lord, the judgment, and the resurrection. And of course, he gave some supportive scriptures. And he says, so Brother Ogden, if all Old Testament prophecy made to Old Covenant Israel has been fulfilled by AD 70, doesn't that mean that the second coming, the judgment, and the resurrection were fulfilled by AD 70? And he said, Brother Ogden stood there like the deer in the headlight look.
Oh, no.
And he said, well, sir, it's more than obvious that I've got to go back home and do some more study.
You know, the introduction of his book to Revelation, and I think you can find that on that same Files to Download page on his website. You just read that and you're going, how does he not see the train coming in some of this?
Yeah.
But, you know, what I try to do is just take a step back and go, you know, they may not have seen it like we see it, but they sure enough laid the groundwork and gave us a great foundation to build on their work and to continue their work to this day. And so it's just, there's just some great stuff on there. You know, Don, I wonder if the lecture you're talking about is the presentation he gave on the date and the fulfillment of Revelation at the Florida College lectureships. Because when you go to that same website, to audio sermon files, there is a presentation he gave at Florida College on the dating of and the fulfillment of the book of Revelation. And it's called The Case for the Early Date. It was February 1994 at the annual Florida College lectureship. Now, the Q&A isn't included, but the presentation is included. And I actually sent that to a friend recently who was asking about the date of Revelation, and he thought it was great. So
I wouldn't be surprised that was the same thing. And by the way, I just tried to log on to www.ogden.com, and it says this site cannot be reached.
It's aogden.com.
No wonder.
Look, you did that on purpose just to really reinforce this idea to the to the listeners. That was a very good good job. Yeah.
There you go. That makes for a good story.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes, on the left, you'll see files to download and also audio sermon files. And both the ones I mentioned are right there. So,
say again, audio sermon files?
Right. Audio sermon files is where you can go listen to The Case for the Early Date. It's under the heading Studies in the Book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Sort of the second section there.
That's great. That is great. I don't know why, but I mean, I carry his book to sell his book. And his son does bookbinding services, and I want to tell you, he really does a beautiful job. And so I've corresponded with him, and I actually asked his son in some correspondence some years ago, because I was ordering another batch of books, and he sort of asked me a vague generic question about how did I come to know about the book, et cetera, et cetera. And I gave him a little bit of background, and I said, are you familiar with the full preterist view? And he said, no, as a matter of fact, I am not. And he said, I have promised myself that I'm going to look into it. But he said, I have to tell you, in all honesty, I have not done so. And I encouraged him to go to my website and take a look, you know, at the articles there. And so I don't know if he ever has. But anyway, if anyone is listening and you want to order a copy of his book, you can contact me, because, like I said, the book is really, really, really great right up to the millennium. And so he has a difficult time with that. But he does really a fine job on this subject and then on this theme of the avenging of the apostles and the prophets. Just does an outstanding job. So, like I said, contact me if you'd like to order a copy of the book, because it is well worth the price, and it is a hardback book. It's a book that you need in your library.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, just the introduction alone and his emphasis on the time statements is just, it's incredible. You really do want to read that and go listen to those and read those files I mentioned a second ago on his website. It's all good stuff.
Yeah. If this debate with Sergius Bale takes place, I'm sure that I will avail myself of some of the information that he has on the persecution or claimed persecution by Domitian. And in my book, Who Is This Babylon? I do actually quote Ogden, by the way, but I document how so many late-date advocates, I'm talking men like Donald Guthrie in his massive, massive tome, Introduction to the New Testament, he says something to the effect, even though the late date is the widely accepted date, it may very well be that the evidence has been overestimated and that the support for a late date is not as well substantiated as has long been held. Now, that's a paraphrase, but that's the gist of what he has to say. And that's a stunning admission, because he takes the late date, and yet here he is saying, I'm not so sure that we can prove this. It's really remarkable. And again, in my book on Who Is This Babylon, I have an entire chapter on the Domitianic persecution. By the way, Daniel, are you familiar with the book, The Myth of Persecution by Candida Moss?
I am not.
You need to get a copy of that book. And our listeners need to get a copy of that book. Candida Moss is a Yale, Harvard graduate. Super, super highly academic achievements. She was teaching at Notre Dame. I don't know if she's still there or not. Again, her name is Candida Moss. The book is The Myth of Persecution.
Now, it's only about $11.39 on Amazon, brand new paperback. Those of you who might want to pick that up too.
Yeah, I went ahead and purchased the hardcover. But nonetheless, yeah.
Well, that's $25. Not everybody has Mustangs to, supplement their book.
No, see, you don't understand. Mustangs cost money to work on. But here's something rather remarkable. Her book is focused on the persecution of Christians. She does not deny in any way, shape, form, or fashion the reality of Jewish persecution in the New Testament. Then she sort of kind of jumps forward to the record of Eusebius, which is the fourth century historian. And in her chronicling of persecution of Christians, she literally says not one word about Domitian.
Wow.
And I actually tried to contact her recently, And the email that I could come up with didn't work, obviously. And so I've got to go through another channel to try to find her. But this is more than remarkable. When the key piece of evidence for a late date of book of Revelation is the supposed Domitianic persecution, and here is a scholar whose academic credentials can hardly be questioned. I mean, you know, Yale, Harvard, Notre Dame. Now, you can question their theology, but she's a historian. And when she doesn't even give, I mean, she doesn't even say, well, you know, it's claimed that Domitian persecuted the church, but we're not going to discuss that because we don't think it's real. No, she doesn't even mention his name. His name is not in the table of contents.
Get this. She says that the Age of Martyrs is a fiction. There was no sustained 300-year-long effort by the Romans to persecute Christians.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what Art Ogden said in this paper I mentioned a second ago. He said, my position in this exchange should not be misunderstood. It is not my place to prove that Domitian did not persecute Christians. The obligation of proof is upon those who advocate the great Domitian persecution. I readily admit that he may have persecuted some Christians. However, neither you nor I have the right to charge him with slaying many thousands and bathing the empire in their blood upon the premises of what he may have done. And then he goes on to say that there is no firsthand evidence contemporary with Domitian saying that he ever persecuted the church.
Yeah.
And that's just,
I mean, it's really, really remarkable.
And that's probably why she didn't talk about it, because there's no sources to go off of.
I think, you know, that is precisely why I think she did not give it even the slightest mention, because, you know, the evidence is not there. And so when you don't have the evidence for it, or when the evidence is so tenuous, and by the way, there is a there's a PDF. My goodness gracious. Let me see here. Let me get into my file real quick here. Because we may have people looking for resources on this very thing. I believe it's an article by a scholar by the name of Wilson. And it is on something like the supposed Domitianic persecution. And I'm not seeing it. Let me see if I can go into my PDF file.
Let's see. From biblicalarchaeology.org, Mark Wilson. Alternative facts, Domitian's persecution of Christians.
Yes. Now, how did you find that so fast?
Well, I Googled Wilson, Domitian persecution.
That's a good and, way to find it, yeah.
Well, and if you're under 30 years old, Google helps you out more than it helps out other people, just to irritate them, you know.
are you trying to dig me there, Daniel?
I mean, I'm saying in any situation, somebody will try to find something online, they can't do it. But as soon as they talk to, you know, one of their grandkids or one of their kids or one of their friends, they just pull it right up. You know, we just have a gift is all. You can fix cars. I can use Google. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, I tell you, it is absolutely amazing. And believe it or not, I do use Google a good bit. I honestly do. But you're just quicker at it.
Yeah, well, you were trying to search through your files, and I went ahead and looked it up online. But yeah, here it is right here. If you want to go find it, you can just search Wilson Domitian persecution, and it'll pull it up on biblicalarchaeology.org. So there you go.
Yeah. Okay, Wilson, Domitianic persecution. We'll try that. The problem
there you go.
The Domitianic date is right there.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so when this, you know, when this alleged persecution falls through and there's no firsthand evidence for it, although there is, of course, evidence for the persecution under Nero, his contemporaries had no problem bringing that up. You know, it just really calls into question this this later date. And, yeah. You know, what I was going to mention a second ago, Dehan, is, you know, the what's kind of sad is, well, I'll just ask you the question. Who, outside of the first century, because obviously we know who the main persecution force was there, outside of the first century, who's been the number one group of people to kill Christians?
Without any doubt whatsoever, as N.T. Wright, as Richard Hayes, as even an older scholar, Adolf Harnack, Rudolf Harnack, said, if we are to believe the evidence, from the very beginning, persecution of the church did not arise from the Romans, but from the Jews.
Yes, that's right. And then outside of the first century, when you move on in the time, the biggest persecutor would be the church.
Absolutely.
You know, in the first century, there's no doubt. We have evidence from Jesus and from history and from Paul and, you know, other apostles. And then Josephus, you know, and then outside of that, we've been the biggest enemy of ourselves, burning each other at the stake, beheading each other, casting each other out of churches. It's, you know, it seems like maybe the focus on the Domitian persecution is maybe make us overlook the, you know, Constantine persecution of Christians. A Christian, right?
So yeah,
it's a shame. But anyways,
Okay. Well, we've shared a good bit of stuff there.
I kind of forgot we were doing a podcast. Kind of thought we were just talking.
We were just kind of going back and forth here and sharing information, and that's good stuff. I'm reminded, and I'll just give this one other quote that I have in my book, Who Is This Babylon? It is a quote from a historian. He is not a theologian. He is a historian. But his name was Richard Niewanger, Niswonger. And Niewanger said, there is virtually no evidence of any kind of any systematic persecution of the early Christians by Domitian. He said, even the evidence for sporadic persecution lacks a great deal of credibility. So here is he's, again, let me reemphasize, he's not a theologian. He doesn't have an axe to grind theologically for late date, early date. He just simply looking at it from the perspective of a historian. What is the evidence? And the evidence, he says, ain't there. And by the way, I would also point out that this kind of evidence and this kind of testimony is growing among scholars. And in my book, Who Is This Babylon, I give a whole bunch of quotations from late date advocates, all of whom attest. Now, is the late date still the accepted norm? Sure. Is it still the consensus? No doubt. I'm not denying that. But nonetheless, in spite of that, there's a growing number of scholars who are beginning to question it. And this Mark Wilson is one of them. And he actually says, and by the way, there are actually two scholars. One of them is this Mark Wilson, and the other is the fellow that you looked up there. What is C.L. Wilson? I've forgotten his name. But anyway, both of them, one of them just openly says, I once accepted the consensus view of the late date. Mark Wilson says that he did as well. And so, and he quotes a whole bunch of scholars, including a Domitian scholar, okay, who refers to the, quote, alternative facts and, quote, fake news. Concerning Domitian as the persecutor of the church. So that's pretty powerful stuff.
It really is. And it's just something that has just been so assumed. I mean, I think Ogden even says this in part of that paper. He says, you might think this is such a strange subject to even talk about because who doesn't believe that Domitian persecuted the church? You know, it's something that's been rammed into our heads, you know.
Well, I was raised with that view. and never questioned that view.
See, I was raised that he persecuted the church, you know, just in passing. But really, we took the early date view, thanks to Franklin Camp and Floyd Wallace.
Franklin Camp.
So, yeah.
Who opened an awful lot of doors for preterism. Thank you very much.
Yep, that's true.
Well, I think it's interesting, and we'll just go ahead and talk here a little bit. But Hugo McCord, he passed away before you came on board. Hugo McCord was a wonderful, wonderful Christian man, one of the most humble men I've ever met. Hugo was part of the Bible department at Oklahoma Christian College years ago. He may actually have been head of the Bible department at one time. I don't remember specifically, but Hugo McCord could sight read the Hebrew and the Greek as well. I mean, he could just read the Hebrew and the Greek as if he were reading, you know, the daily newspaper in English. He was just absolutely brilliant and incredibly academic. Well, he wrote a little book commentary on the book Revelation. I had a copy of it when I moved from Shawnee, Oklahoma to Ardmore. I lost it. I don't know what in the world I did with it. I haven't been able to Google and find a copy of it. So go to work there, you know. Go to work, Daniel, find me a copy. But anyway, it was a commentary on the book Revelation. It was a little paperback book. It wasn't big at all.
The Royal Route of Revelation? Or Royal Route of Revelation? The Royal Route of Revelation? Route? Route?
However, I don't know. I don't know. That might be it.
Little blue book with looks like a lake or something. Or the Isle of Patmos on the front?
Look, it's been so long.
Okay, well, anyways, I found it. So.
Okay, wow, you are fast. So anyway, in the introduction to the book, under the dating of the book, he says this: if one were to rely exclusively on the internal evidence of the book Revelation, there could be no disputing that it was written before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. However, and you know, you're sitting there and you read that and you go, wait, hang on. So the book itself dates itself to prior to AD 70. However, Brother McCord said, we have the testimony of Irenaeus, who says it was written under the reign of Domitian. I will never, ever forget reading that and going, Brother McCord, did you stop to read what you just wrote? My goodness. So, uninspired second century writer carry more weight than the testimony of the inspired book itself.
Wow.
I was flabbergasted. I simply could not believe what I was reading from this incredibly scholarly man who had an unshakable faith in the inspiration and the authority of Scripture, and yet here he was pitting the internal testimony of inspiration against the uninspired testimony of a man who, by any standard of measure, was a Fruit Loop. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Irenaeus... I, you know, the more I read Irenaeus, the more I'm convinced that anybody would put all of their eggs in that basket are going to wind up with a basket full of broken eggs.
Wow.
The guy had some really, really, really weird ideas that dispensationalists might accept them, although the argument's been... See, Irenaeus believed that the earth would only last for 6,000 years, and at the beginning of the 7,000 year, that would be the beginning of the millennium. Well, that, you know, has been pretty effectively debunked, but that was a foundational belief for Irenaeus. So on and on it goes, that it's just staggering that people put so much weight on the evidence of uninspired men, as opposed to the internal evidence. And I know what the argument is. The argument very often is, well, the evidence from inside the book that you're looking at is just a matter of interpretation. Well, I can tell you this, ladies and gentlemen, the statements made by Irenaeus, supposedly concerning the dating of the book, are very, very, very much a matter of interpretation. And world-class scholars down through the years say that the interpretation that says that Irenaeus says the book of Revelation was seen in the time of Domitian is a false interpretation. So it's not a matter of history versus interpretation at all. Not at all. I'll take the evidence concerning what the Bible has to say in Revelation about itself that are clear, concise, unambiguous, and even interpretive over the testimony of this second century, again, I'm sorry, fruit loop, idiosyncratic, boy, the guy, yeah, I'm sorry, he's just strange. He should not be taken as an ultimate authority on almost anything, in my estimation. I've got an entire list in my files that I've garnered through the years as I read Irenaeus of his idiosyncratic, weird, and in some instances just all but heretical views. And yet, boy, he's the pillar. he's the bastion of evidence for the late date. Okay, sorry, don't accept it.
Yeah, I'd rather go with, Paul and James and Jesus and John, you know.
Yeah, they're fairly good testimony, yeah. So anyway, back to the debate situation. Be looking for that, ladies and gentlemen, because Lord willing, nothing else interferes. That will be coming up here before very long, and I do hope that it takes place. I'm counting on it taking place, to be honest about it. I've been trying already to kind of put some thoughts together. Certainly nothing is finalized. And by the way, William, I sent, Daniel, I sent you an attachment a while ago with kind of a rough draft of what I may or may not, for that matter, present, but in this debate, if it ever takes place. So you might take a look at that. And if you have some time, I know you're busy, and that's fine if you don't, but I did send a draft to you of what I do propose to use if the debate takes place.
Okay, yeah, I'd be glad to take a look at
it. All right, very good. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are a little bit late this morning getting started on our subject. Our subject is the Messianic Temple. We've been focused on John chapter 4 for the last couple of weeks, and we have pointed out that Jesus's reference, couple of different references in John chapter 4 are related to the fulfillment of Israel's feast days, and specifically Sukkot, the Feast of Harvest, as well as Shemini Atzeret. And the reason for that is simple. Jesus alludes to several Old Testament prophecies concerning living waters flowing out of the temple or out of the New Jerusalem. Passages such as Isaiah 44, of Zechariah chapter 14, of Ezekiel 40 to 47. And these three Old Testament prophecies of the last days of the Messianic Temple and living waters flowing and being made available to believers are in the background when Jesus, on the very last day of the Feast of Sukkot, the Feast of Harvest, which is, you know, the time which in the Jewish understanding of things is the time of the arrival of salvation, the arrival of the new creation, the arrival of the resurrection. And look, over the last several months, I have been compiling from the literature in the research that I've been doing, an entire list of motifs and themes that the ancient Jews associated with the Feast of Sukkot. Obviously, harvest. But among other things, they also associated the renewal of the covenant, in which God would renew his covenant with his people. It is associated with the time of the coronation of the king. It is associated with the consecration of the temple, along with the other issues that I have already mentioned. So just think about that, folks. In the mind of the Jews, every time they gathered together, these themes, these motifs, were brought to their mind in very powerful imagery, symbolism, and prophetic foreshadowings as they anticipated the coming of their redemption, which would result, and this is so powerfully brought out in the Feast of Tabernacles, Israel's salvation would result in the salvation being offered to the nations. And as, man, one scholar after another, and I mentioned an article last week by Charles Vernoff. He wrote an article, The Feast of Redemption. It is in PDF form. It's available. Guess what? You can Google that, Daniel. There's an idea for you. I recommend, folks, you got to get that article. You got to read that article. It's one of the richest articles, full of suggestive thought, pregnant with meaning. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic. He shares and documents from the ancient sources, from the primary sources, all of these symbolic meanings of Sukkot, which segues into Shemini Atzeret. And by the way, this imagery, when Jesus, on the last day of Sukkot, on the seventh day of Sukkot, and then I got to get back to this salvation issue and the salvation for the nations. But on that very last day, the day of Sukkot, Jesus stood up and he said, "If any man comes to me, living water shall flow from his belly." Folks, that is Jesus saying, I am the fulfillment of Sukkot. I am the resurrection and the life. And if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. Shemini Atzeret. Now, very quickly, and then I'm going to turn this over to Daniel for him to bring in some thoughts. I mentioned a moment ago that in the Feast of Sukkot, and remember the significance of Jesus standing up that day, the last day of Sukkot, and yelling out, "I am the light of the world." Well, guess what? That's the Feast of Sukkot imagery. Because during the Feast of Sukkot, they had candelabras in the court of Israel, the court of the priests specifically. These candelabras were 75 feet tall. And there were several of them there. And the light from those candles, and they were actually containers, they were bowls with wicks of oil put in them, and the wicks hung out over the edges of the bowls. But the rabbis used to say that the entire city of Jerusalem was lit by the power of those incredible bowls. So here's Jesus, "I'm the light of the world." That's Sukkot. "If any man believes in me, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." That's Sukkot. So the imagery here is just overwhelmingly powerful. And now notice what that meant. Let me say it like this. The Feast of Sukkot, and remember, this is all temple imagery. And let me drop a little atom bomb right here, ladies and gentlemen. The typology, the foreshadowing of Sukkot, as well as Yom Kippur, as well as Rosh Hashanah, those feast days had to be fulfilled antitypically while that Old Covenant temple was still standing. I mean, after all, the first four feasts were fulfilled while the temple was standing. And those last three feast days were temple-centric. So guess where that puts us in regard to the temporal delimitation of when the last three feast days would be fulfilled? Hello? The temple had to be standing when the typological meaning of Rosh Hashanah, which was the judgment, of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, coming of the Lord, and Sukkot and Shemini, the new creation, salvation, redemption, etc. The temple had to be standing when those feasts were fulfilled. I don't know of a more powerful demonstration, Daniel, of covenant eschatology when we look at those last three feast days as what I've been writing an article on this issue over the last couple of weeks, but I've entitled the article Temple Eschatology. Because that's exactly what it is. No temple, no eschatology.
And that was the problem with Hymenaeus and Philetus, wasn't it? They were trying to affirm that the resurrection had already taken place while the temple was still standing. And in effect, they were excluding the Gentiles from being fellow heirs with Israel, you know, at least without having, you know, at least as long as they didn't go through all the rituals and things like that to proselytize. I mean, that was exactly their offense.
That's exactly right.
Jesus, as Paul mentions there, Jesus was the foundation. No man can lay any other foundation. And Jesus is the foundation of the new temple. And they were basically casting him out, you know, casting him out of the way in teaching that the resurrection had passed. But,
well, it's just such a powerful concept that it is. And here's an ironic twist. The dispensationalists understand how important temple is to eschatology. That's why they insist on the building of a literal temple for Jesus to dwell in and to fulfill the feast days. They understand temple eschatology. The trouble of it is, they just rip it out of its chronological context by 2,000 years.
I mean, right.
So yeah, it's just absolutely amazing. So amillennialism, the view in which I was raised, in which you were raised, has no clue whatsoever in this regard. The temple was totally nullified in at the cross, according to amillennialism. Oh, there are a few scragglers in the amillennial world who say, well, Arthur Ogden's one of them. Okay, the Old Testament was fulfilled, not at the cross, but in AD 70. Okay, great. But he wasn't consistent with it. That doesn't mean he was being dishonest at all. He was a good, sincere brother. It's just that he wasn't following through. And when Jack Scott pointed out how he needed to connect the dots between what he was saying and what the Bible said, he was honest enough and courageous enough right there in that meeting in front of all of those brethren. I got to go back home and restudy. I really like that.
Yeah, that's great. That's really what we're searching for when we have these discussions, is not total agreement right up front, but the ability to say, maybe I've missed something, maybe I need to take a step back and rethink this thing. That's really what we desire. And you know, we don't want anybody to conform to what we believe just because we believe it. We want them to be willing to study. And if we are wrong, well, man, Don, wouldn't it be great to be wrong and be able to go back and have good Christian fellowship with all these people who've cast us out? You know?
Oh my goodness, I have said that on so many occasions. Yeah. I've said to people, some of whom would have cost me, and I use that word relatively, they would do so with respect and courtesy. And I've told them, I said, look, listen, brother, let me tell you something. I didn't want to be where I am right now. I did not want to be where I am because I knew what my brethren in the churches of Christ would do to me should I take a firm stand on what I was seeing. And I've told people, in the churches of Christ, we shoot our wounded. We don't heal them, we shoot them.
Yeah, that's right.
And anyone taking a view outside of the accepted orthodoxy of the churches of Christ, and it's not just churches of Christ, this is across the spectrum.
You know, of course.
Anyone stepping outside of the accepted orthodoxy is, you know, they're just automatically a heretic and they're to be shot and what have you. But I have told people, I came to where I am kicking and screaming, fighting every inch of the way. I have said, oh my goodness, pardon me, I cannot count the number of people I've said this to. I have said, you would do me the greatest favor in the world if you could show me I'm wrong so that I could repent of my error and be accepted once again into the good graces of my brethren. But I also add this caveat. I know what I used to believe. I know what you believe, I have said to these brothers. I may know it better than you do. But I can tell you this, unless you've got something better than what I once believed, unless you've got better evidence than what I once had, you're not going to convince me because I know what's wrong with that evidence.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've told some of the some of the new heavens and new earth guys who've kind of taken after N.T. Wright, I've told them, you know, I've got to give it to you guys. You're actually trying to be consistent because you're lining up the nature of the resurrection with the nature of the new heavens and new earth.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate what you're doing there. I think it's the wrong direction, but at least it's an attempt at consistency.
Yes, it is.
You know, going back to what we were talking about a minute ago, I wanted to read this passage from Hebrews because if there's a passage that talks about temple eschatology, it's this text. And I was going to add before reading it that maybe the reason why I didn't see temple eschatology before, and maybe you, is because of the version that we were using, the version of the Bible. Let me just read this and kind of show what's going on here. In Hebrews 9 and verse 8. The scripture says, the Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing. Now, the word standing, the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, indicates a present reality, right? Not something that was... that had been accomplished, but something that would be accomplished. It was an ongoing thing. Now, in the King James Version, listen to what he says here. The Holy Ghost, this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing. So we have still standing versus yet standing. And just that minor difference can transform how you read this passage. Now, he goes on in Hebrews chapter 9 to say this. This outer tabernacle, he says, is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience. He's talking about things that were going on presently in the temple. They were currently being offered. Since they relate to only food and the drink and various washings, regulations for the body, he says, the idea of the flesh there, imposed until a time of reformation. Don, you've pointed out that the word apokatastasis in Acts chapter 3, the restoration of all things, is a synonym of this word here, diorthosis, in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 10. He says then in verse 11, but when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things to come, there's your Colossians 2:16 passage, He entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation. Mm-hmm. So we have the old creation, the present time, the tabernacle still standing, versus the new creation, not made with hands, the good things to come. And if there's any passage that talks about temple theology, that's got to be it right there.
I have used Hebrews 9 in countless discussions. And I'll share this very, very quickly. Some years ago, while I was before I got terminated from my preaching position at the Maximal Church of Christ here in Ardmore, Oklahoma, the elders surreptitiously reached out to Brother Buster Dobbs from the Houston area at the time. Brother Dobbs considered himself to be the final definitive answer and refutation of covenant eschatology. Well, I was supposed to be out of town, take a little bit of time off, and unbeknownst to me, the elders reached out to Buster Dobbs and asked him if he would come to Shawnee, or Ardmore, excuse me, and give a presentation. And he brought along with him a guy named Don Cain. And somehow or other, I found out about that, and I decided not to leave. And I'm telling a little bit of the full story here in order to get the full impact. And so I showed up on Sunday morning. You've never seen such shocked look on the faces of elders in all of your life. In fact, one of the elders literally walked up to me and said, "What in the world are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here." And I was like, I told him, I said, "I work here." And of course, I didn't work there much longer. But anyway, he said again, "You're not supposed to be here." Well, I knew something was up. And so I wasn't planning on preaching. I took my place down toward the front, and I started getting a whisper here and there in my ear about what was going to take place. And then I saw Brother Dobbs. One of the elders got up and said, "Tonight, or this morning, or this evening, rather, excuse me, we're going to have a very special presentation by Brother Buster Dobbs from Houston." He didn't even say what it was about. He said, "We want everybody to be here." Well, of course, I learned what it was all about, so I went in and met with the elders that afternoon, and I said, "Okay, brethren," I said, I just told them, I said, "This is pretty much backstabbing. This is underhanded. This is not scrupulous." And I said, "Let me tell you something. When Buster Dobbs gets up there and speaks, whatever he says, I'm going to get up and answer." And they said, Oh, yeah. They said, "Don, that's what we intended all along." And I just told them, I said, "No, it wasn't, brethren. Don't tell me that. You thought I was going to be out of town. So don't tell me you intended for me to get up and follow him." And they just sit there, like a bunch of rocks. Okay, so Dobbs gives his presentation. And he kept talking about the future redemption, future salvation at the coming of the Lord. I went right straight to Hebrews chapter 9. And by the way, during his presentation, he made the massive mistake of talking about when we die now, we go to Hades, and we await the resurrection so that we could go to heaven. So I got up, and for my allotted time of about 40 minutes, I expounded on Hebrews chapter 9. And I just pointed out that if what Brother Dobbs said in his presentation is true, we have no forgiveness of sin because no one could enter into heaven while the old law stood. Brother Dobbs doesn't believe we go to heaven today. Why? Well, it could only be because we don't have forgiveness of our sin, which means that the old law is still standing. And I emphasized that the Greek text of Hebrews 9, 6 to 10, almost every Greek verb there is in the present active indicative. I had people come up to me after that presentation, Daniel, and they told me, they said, "You know what? We've been listening to what you had to say, but that lesson put the nail in the coffin."
Wow.
That is what convinced us absolutely of what you were saying. Our position that we have always had is wrong. I mean, person after person. And you know what? With that, Daniel, we are out of time. And so I want to thank everyone for joining us. We didn't get to the Messianic Temple except peripherally this morning. And so we will we'll try to pick that up again next week. And I've got my wife calling in on the phone here, it looks like. So I want to thank you so very, very much for joining us on Two Guys in the Bible. Daniel, great to be with you as always. And with that, I'm going to say good night and God bless.